Well, good morning. And good morning. This past week has been quite amazing for scientific discoveries, but I'm not going to tell you about these amazing scientific discoveries. They're going to have to come next week because there's some stuff we need to get through in terms of our lessons. So, and we've been talking a lot about what God has done to make it possible for Christ to come here on planet Earth. To do what he did here on the planet, but also to give us marching orders. I mean, when he left this planet after his crucifixion, he told his disciples, I want you to take the good news of how you can receive salvation through me to all the people groups of the world, and what that takes to make that possible. So what I'm going to do is kind of quickly review five amazing, miraculous events in the history of the Earth that makes possible, number one, a large human population, number two, the incarnation, and number three, the capacity of followers of Jesus Christ to literally take the good news of salvation to all the people groups of the world. So, five major tectonic events, and by the way, if one of these doesn't happen, you can't have a large human population, you can't have technology. The events that we see recorded in the Bible wouldn't be possible. We wouldn't have what we need to fulfill what God has asked us to do. So, the first of these things, you need Antarctica. If you don't have Antarctica, nothing works. Okay. Now, the history of Antarctica was, at one time, it was attached to Australia. It split off from Australia, but it was still attached to South America. Then it split off from South America and wound up in this position. Now, I purposely left Australia on here because you can see what's called the Great Australian Bight here. Notice this Great Australian Bight matches this part of Antarctica. And so what happened is Antarctica was attached to Australia and split off and headed in a southwardly direction, but wound up being attached to the south tip of Antarctica. So 40, 30 million years ago, this is the situation. You've got a land bridge joining South America and Antarctica. And the problem with that is it stopped the circulation of currents and winds around Antarctica. And so eventually we have Antarctica splitting off, and this allows this great ocean circulation. And by the way, it's not just ocean. We also have winds. The strongest and steadiest winds on the planet are around Antarctica. They call it the Roaring Forties. And it's roughly in the 40 degrees latitude, but it's also a 40-mile-per-hour wind that never gets less than 40 miles per hour. But it's stimulated by this great ocean current that goes around Antarctica. And then when Antarctica split off from South America to the degree that it's split off today, this allowed the circulation, both winds and water, to be strong enough that you not only that, but it allowed snow to accumulate. Now notice, we have Antarctica splitting off from Australia, breaking off from South America, and it moves, and when it hits the South Pole, it literally stops. So I have this motion, and then it just suddenly stops. It stops virtually right on top of the South Pole. And then with this great circulation going around it, you have an episode from 3.15 to 2.75 million years ago. So just think, somewhere between 2.75 million years ago and 3.15 million years ago, Antarctica got its ice. So while it was still attached to Australia, while it was still attached to South America, it didn't have ice. The ice all built up literally within that narrow window of time. How much ice are we talking about? 8 million cubic kilometers of ice got deposited upon Antarctica in that small window of time. Now, if you don't like kilometers, that translates to 2 million cubic miles. Okay. So 2 million cubic miles of ice. That's a lot of ice, right? That's why we have Antarctica covered with thousands of feet of ice today. That all happened 2.75 to 3.15 million years ago. Now, I want you to remember that date, because that date shows up again and again as we look at other tectonic events. Okay, while this was going on, we had another break-off of a continent. We had at one time the Indian subcontinent attached to Antarctica. It split off from Antarctica. Then it became attached to Madagascar. And then it split off from Madagascar. And when it split off from Madagascar, it began a rapid tectonic movement. In fact, it's the most rapid tectonic movement that geophysicists know of in the history of the Earth. There's never been a faster tectonic movement than this one you see right here, where the Indian subcontinent breaks off from Madagascar and heads at a very high velocity towards Eurasia. See, what kind of velocity you're talking about? Well, the minimum was 15 centimeters a year. The maximum was about 20 or 21 centimeters per year. Now, to a geophysicist, that's really high speed. I mean, you're really roaring when you're moving at that velocity. And it maintained that velocity until it got to about here. And then when it got to about there, it began to encounter a shallow sea. And it began to encounter the shallow sea that developed some friction and caused the velocity to slow down. And then when it hit land, it got into more resistance and slowed down some more. And when it hit land, this is really what caused the Himalayas to pop up. So if you were to climb Mount Everest, what you'd discover at the top of Mount Everest, if you chip your way through all the ice, is a whole bunch of seashells. Literally, the entire Himalayas is uplifted seafloor as a direct result of the Indian subcontinent smashing into Eurasia. Now, it's still happening to this day. Now, it's no longer 20 centimeters a year. It's only 5 centimeters a year. But that does rank as the highest velocity of any tectonic movement happening on the planet today. So we still have this very rapid movement of India into Asia, which explains why the Himalayas are the fastest growing mountains in the world. They're still being uplifted. And I don't know any of you who are old enough to remember Sir Edmund Hillary climbing Mount Everest for the first time. He no longer is on record as climbing the highest mountain, because now Mount Everest is higher than it was when he climbed it, by literally more than a foot. It's more than a foot higher than it was when he climbed it. So, but that's a direct result of the fact that the collision is still taking place. Now, as that collision is taking place, what it has done is caused the Himalayas to go up, but not just the Himalayas. Everything behind the Himalayas, likewise, is being lifted up. They call it the Tibetan Plateau. And so the pushing up of the Tibetan Plateau generated what's called an equatorial polar cap. I mean, you've got Antarctica with ice, you got the polar ice cap, but what's unusual about planet Earth is we actually have an ice cap that's somewhat close to the equator. And I've mentioned this class before. Even today, in a warm interglacial, we have, as the third largest store of ice on the planet, not the Arctic ice cap, but rather the ice cap that exists over the Tibetan Plateau in the Himalayas. There's actually more ice there than there is in the polar ice cap, at least during the summer polar ice cap. So yeah, Antarctica's got the greatest store of ice. Greenland is next. And then number three is the ice that's stored over the Himalayas and the Tibetan Plateau. And by the way, the Tibetan Plateau is continuing to go up. So, in fact, there's some geophysicists say in the near future, you're going to have a permanent ice cap covering all of the Tibetan Plateau. What's happening now is the Tibetan Plateau gets covered with thousands of feet of ice during an ice age, but during a warm interglacial, all that ice melts except for a little bit of the Himalayas, a little bit around the Himalayas. Still a lot of ice, but it's much more when you're in an ice age. Okay, so those are two tectonic events. You've got Antarctica. You've got India crashing into Eurasia. And by the way, the ice that's over the Himalayas reflects sunlight four times more efficiently than the sunlight falling over the Greenland ice cap. For obvious reasons, because the sunlight's hitting it directly as opposed to an angle when you're, say, in Antarctica or in Greenland. And so the cooling effect here, and by the way, this is what's happening. You do not get an ice age cycle unless you cool the planet. Let me take you back to this slide. Okay. This is a history of the brightening of the sun. And so what you discover is that we're now in a phase, and this has been the case throughout the entire history of life, where the sun is getting progressively brighter and brighter. We do have a few ice ages in here. You can count them on one hand, and none of them are an ice age cycle. And there's really only a few. Most of the time, the planet is so warm, there's no ice anywhere. The amazing thing is, here we are at this episode where the sun is brighter than it's ever been in the history of life, and we've got an ice age cycle. We have an ice age cycle because of five amazing tectonic events that supercooled the planet. So even though the sun is very bright, we're now living in an era where we have an ice age, and not just an ice age cycle. Now, to get an ice age cycle, you have to bring the planet to a temperature where you're barely hovering between no ice at all and then extensive ice. And that's what's happening. We're living in an episode of the history of the Earth where we've got this very delicate balance between no ice and ice. But given how bright the sun is, it takes these five simultaneous tectonic events to cool the planet sufficiently that we can reach that point where we're in this delicate balance that initiates an ice age cycle. And been with us for the past few weeks, I've been making the point, only if you've got an ice age cycle can you have advanced civilization. You can't have it with an ice age, you can't have it with no ice, you can only have it when you've got an ice age cycle. Now, let's go back to the tectonic events. So one of them is what took place with Antarctica, allowing a huge amount of ice to pack onto Antarctica. And there's two effects here. One, the ice that covers all of Antarctica reflects a lot of sunlight away, so that cools the planet. But the other thing is the circulation pattern has an effect of cooling the oceans of the world. And so you actually get a global cooling impact because of the positioning of Antarctica, where there's open ocean all the way around. And so, literally, the only continent where you've got this huge swath of open ocean all the way around, setting up the current, which has the impact of literally cooling all the oceans of the world. And then you've got this event, which actually sets up an ice cap over an equatorial region, and as I said, that actually has a factor of four greater cooling impact than the equivalent amount of ice at the poles. Okay, number three is what happened to Greenland. This is a map of North America and basically shows you the land ice during the height of summer. Now, in wintertime, you got more ice than that, but that's what it looks like in the height of summer. But what geophysicists have discovered, and by the way, this discovery is literally only 3 weeks old. Brand new discovery that Greenland was not always there. It was basically off of Newfoundland and then began to move fairly rapidly, 18 degrees north latitude. And as it moved north, it moved over parts of the tectonic plate, or the, what they call the lithosphere, where it got warmer and warmer. And then it stopped going north when it settled over a hot spot. Now, what do you mean by hot spots? For example, Hawaii is over what's called a tectonic hot spot, where you got these plumes coming up from the deep mantle, forming these volcanoes, and that explains why we have the Hawaiian Islands and why Hawaii is the fastest growing state in the Union, in the sense that it's getting more and more land area because of the fact that it's sitting over that hot spot. Well, we now know that Greenland is sitting over a hot spot. But the amazing thing is, it started off by Newfoundland. Tectonically, it moved north, and when it got over the hot spot, it stopped moving. But when it got over that hot spot, what that did is it caused all of eastern Greenland to go up in elevation by 3 kilometers. Now, again, if you don't like the miles, it's 2 miles elevation. So, if you go back to when it was sitting over Newfoundland, Greenland was basically not much above sea level. All of Greenland was just kind of, you know, a few hundred feet above sea level. Now, simply moving Greenland north would not explain the ice cap over Greenland. In order to make it cold enough, given how bright the sun is, it's necessary to move Greenland right up next to the pole and then have it uplifted by this hot plume from the mantle so that it literally is 2 miles above sea level. And then that makes it cold enough that you can get this gigantic ice cap forming over Greenland. And as you look at the map, the northern tip of Greenland is the closest to the North Pole of any landmass on planet Earth. We're talking about 700 kilometers, or about 425 miles from the North Pole. And so that is thanks to its movement. And what that did is it caused all that ice to accumulate, and that reflects away heat. But it did something else. The movement of Greenland up north created this almost enclosed Arctic Sea. So here's the fourth tectonic event that you need to get the planet cool enough to have an ice age cycle. What you need are the continents, many of the continents, to move in a northerly direction. And what you see here, and this is, by the way, the first time in the history of the Earth where we've had this much landmass in the northern hemisphere. And notice how much of the landmass is at high latitudes. I mean, you look at Russia, you look at Canada, that's a good chunk of the total landmass of the planet, and it's all up at high latitudes. But it's such, with the movement of Greenland up here, we have this Arctic Sea that's virtually enclosed. Look at the islands you've got here, and it's that enclosure plus the current that moves through here, the Gulf Stream, that allows precipitation to fall over the Arctic Sea and an ice cap to form. And so if it wasn't for that enclosure, and if it wasn't for, well, there's one other event that's necessary to get an ice cap. And that event is the forming of the Isthmus of Panama. Until 3 million years ago, there was an ocean link between the Pacific Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean right here. Let me see if I can get a map here for you. Here we go. So, just 10 million years ago, you had a nice wide strait separating North America and South America, which allowed water flow to go through. And with that water flow, you wound up having the Atlantic and the Pacific having the same saltiness. You also wound up having the same temperature. And then 5 million years ago, we see that North and South America are coming closer together, and it begins to set up some changes in the ocean currents. And then 3 million years ago, we actually have the isthmus forming. And what that does, it makes a major change in the ocean currents and basically cuts off the flow of water from the Pacific into the Atlantic. So today, the Atlantic is saltier than the Pacific, and that is an impact of changing the precipitation patterns. And also now you've got land mass blocking these currents. Yes?
Are you going to be putting this material in a new book?
This is all in a new book. The book is written. It's now being edited. It'll be out in about a year. So the editors are going through this stuff and saying this is all so new that we got to find some way to help the lay reader actually realize this stuff is all true. So, and also they're concerned because I got 19,000 words of citations, and they say, "Hey, wait a minute." however, because this material is so new, I think it was really crucial to document it very well, so that people can understand, "Hey, this is something you can really count on," even though it's all fairly new discoveries in geophysics. So, this is kind of what North and South America look like today. And this kind of shows you where you've got a land barrier running north and south. And the ocean currents and the winds hit this barrier, and they're basically forced north and south. And it's the forcing of the currents and the wind patterns north and south that is a global cooling effect. And also the fact that we have greater salt in the Atlantic Ocean, North Atlantic, actually has changed the precipitation patterns. Now, it had a global cooling effect, but it has a tremendous benefit for those of us who live in the Americas. What this did is it forced the rainfall of precipitation to be much more evenly distributed over North and South America. So thanks to the Isthmus of Panama, we can have people living at all latitudes down North and South America. that wouldn't have been possible if the isthmus hadn't formed 3 million years ago. But bottom line, notice this, everything's coming in at around 2¾ and 3 million years. So you have these five tectonic events all happening simultaneously, each one of them crucial to cool the planet enough. Again, take any one of these four out, you will not get an ice age cycle. You need all five happening at the same time in order to get an ice age cycle. And that ice age cycle was initiated 2.588 million years ago. They now got it down to four places a decimal. That's when the ice age cycle started, yes.
I presume that the Panama Canal and the new canal they're thinking about building would not affect this at all as far as going back to that. You don't get that much...
Well, you don't get that much water flowing through, and it's not going to affect the wind patterns. So the currents are still going to be butting up. Now, if you made the thing sufficiently wide that you could have 10 ships abreast going through, yeah, now you might have a problem. That would be too much water exchange taking place. So as long as the water exchange is limited, it won't be an issue.
They have locks. There is no water exchange.
Yeah, they got locks.
Boats go up to a lake and down again.
Right.
They go into fresh water, then go down.
Right, right. So, not a problem. Okay. With these five tectonic events, we now got a delicate balance on planet Earth where it's at the right temperature in spite of how bright the sun is, where we're on a hairy edge between ice and no ice. And what I mean by that is permanent ice and no ice at all, which means that the balance is sensitive enough that something they call the Milankovitch cycles takes a role. The Milankovitch cycles are referring to the very tiny variations in Earth's orbit. And the two that are most significant are the changes in the tilt of the plane of the orbit of the Earth relative to the solar system. Doesn't tilt by much. The greatest extent of the tilt is that our rotation axis changes from 22.5 degrees to 24 degrees. Right now it's 23.5. But the range of movement is 22.5 to 24. What's the cycle? It's 41,000 years. So every 41,000 years, it tilts back and forth between 22.5. Well, it goes from 22.5 to 24 to 22.5 in 41,000 years. Now, what's the big deal about that? Well, the greater the tilt, the greater the difference between summer and winter. And so that difference, that seasonal difference, actually affects the global mean temperature. Now, the other effect is the shape of the Earth's orbit. All planets have an elliptical shape. That's something Isaac Newton discovered. Planets do not have circular orbits, they have elliptical orbits. But the ellipticity of Earth's orbit changes very slightly. There are times when the ellipticity is greater and times when it's less. You say, what are we talking about? Well, no ellipticity at all would be zero. Extreme ellipticity, where the Earth no longer orbits around the Sun, but it becomes a parabola, would be one. The ellipticity of the Earth goes from about 0.005 up to about 0.059. That's kind of the range. And right now we're getting closer to the higher end. And that too has the effect of heightening the seasons. Now, the cycle of the variation of the ellipticity of Earth's orbit is 100,000 years. Now, when the Ice Age cycle was ignited 2.588 million years ago, it was a 41,000 year cycle. And that's what you get when the cooling is barely enough to initiate the cycle. However, these tectonic events I'm speaking about are still continuing. For example, the most prominent was what's happening in Tibet. Tibet is still going up, which means that the cooling over that last 2.59 million years gets greater and greater as time goes on. It explains, for example, why the last ice age was the most severe ice age we had in the entire cycle. Each ice age gets a little more severe as a direct result of Tibet going up a little bit more. Now, what that did is that it changed the period of the ice age from 41,000 years to 100,000 years. So as the planet gets a little bit cooler, it changes the variation from a 41,000 year period to a 100,000 year period. So the ellipticity of Earth's orbit now has the dominant effect. When did that happen? About 800,000 years ago. So only in the last 800,000 years have we had a 100,000 year ice age cycle. Okay, why is that important? Okay, here are the last four ice ages. You know, 100,000 years, you get a warm interglacial. So every 100,000 years, you get a warm interglacial. Now, that also happens with a 41,000 year cycle. But here's the problem. If it's only a 41,000 year cycle, your warm interglacial is going to be much briefer. Instead of having 10 or 12,000 years of a warm episode, you're now looking at maybe 2 to 3,000 years. It's hard to get human civilization developed enough where you can have billions of people on the planet at one time if all you got to work with is a couple of thousand years. But if you got 10 or 12,000 years, now you got enough time to make things happen. So yes, you want the Lord Jesus Christ to come when the ice age cycle is 100,000 years. And I won't review this again, but it's thanks to that ice that we can actually have water being distributed to all the agricultural land masses. We can have nutrients being cycled to all those agricultural land masses. We can have hydropower. Well, I'm not going to review it again. There's a dozen things that we all take for granted that wouldn't be here if we were not following the most severe ice age of the ice age cycle. And so our population, our high technology, is all thanks to the fact that we are living right after the most severe the ice age cycle. And by the way, there are many geophysicists who think it indeed will be the most severe, because they're actually predicting that when we come into another ice age, Tibet will now be so high above sea level that we won't be able to come out of the ice age. So we literally may be indeed living after the most severe ice age in the ice age cycle, given that the ice age cycle is going to come to an end. Now, by the way, there will come a time when there will be no ice age cycle because the sun is continuing to brighten. But here's the problem. Tibet is being tectonically uplifted at a much faster rate than the brightening of the sun. And so this is why a number of geophysicists are persuaded the ice age cycle is going to end and we're going to have a permanent ice age until the sun gets so bright that we can never have ice for the rest of the history of the Earth. So, but again, this is somewhat speculative in the sense that we're not able to understand exactly to what degree the extent of the Tibetan uplift is taking place. And by the way, there will come a time when the collision of the Indian subcontinent will slow down to a point where the uplift will stop. As long as it's moving north at 5 centimeters a year, it's going to continue to uplift considerably. And so what's putting this into some form of unsettled debate is we don't know what's going to happen in the future as the Indian subcontinent continues to push into Eurasia. Will we see a slowdown in the velocity? When will it stop? That's all being debated. But as you can see from this particular graph, we have a problem for civilization, or the potential for civilization, in the sense that if you look at this warm interglacial, what you see is the temperature spikes up fairly rapidly, hits a maximum, and drops. And in this case, it went up even faster. Very fast rise and dropped. How can you establish civilization if the temperature is changing that rapidly? In fact, people have pointed out, as long as you've got rapid changes taking place, period, you can't launch large-scale agriculture. It was 6 weeks ago a paper got published making the point that the temperature is jumping up and down by 3 degrees centigrade over the course of several centuries, then it's simply impossible to launch and sustain large-scale agriculture, and actually explains why the human population was so low until we reached the Neolithic Revolution. Until then, we never really had many people on the face of the Earth.
The next ice age, could it possibly go into a snowball effect and everything would become extinct if not?
Well, it's possible as Tibet continues to go up that the next ice age will be so severe that it will be permanent. But we're not looking at an ice ball. The sun is too bright to give us an ice ball or a slush ball. And if you're not familiar with that term, if you go back about 700 million years, Earth had an ice age that was almost a slush ball event. And a slush ball event is where you got ice covering the planet down to about 15 degrees above the equator. So you got a thin layer around the equator, 20, 30 degrees of latitude, where you got open water and the rest of it is all ice. And so that makes it quite difficult to have a very large biomass or biodiversity on the planet. But yeah, the last time that happened was about 750 million years ago. And they used to think maybe it went down to the equator. They now know, hey, there's a significant portion of the tropics that was ice-free. And if you go back 2 billion years ago, we have another slush ball event. Yes?
You've said in the past that the reason that the reason the planet didn't have a large population before the flood, when people were living hundreds of years, was because mostly of murder. Do you think now with this new information that this has something to do with it too?
Well, even if you had murder under control, you wouldn't be able to sustain the kind of agricultural activity that's necessary to maintain a large population. Excuse me. I mean, you do have God saying to Adam and Eve, multiply and fill the earth. So they could have multiplied, they could have extended themselves over the kind of the land masses, but as long as you're in an ice age, so every time you have an ice age, the temperature is going up and down quite radically. And that prevents large-scale agriculture. So you could have millions of people, but you couldn't have billions.
What was the extent of the ice on the earth at that point in time?
Well, let me pull up a graph here for you. Okay.
What is this picture you got up here now?
Oh,
very curious.
that's just a screensaver from Apple. That just shows a wave that someone is actually trying to surf. Here we go. This is the maximum extent of the last ice age, which, by the way, is only 21,000 years ago. So a lot of ice melted in a hurry as we came out of the ice age. And this is the most extensive of the ice ages for the past 2.59 million years. But literally, it came right down to Cincinnati. So all of Ohio was covered in ice. So, and by the way, this just shows you where the big ice sheets, the thick ice sheets are. It does not show you the smaller ice sheets that were only, say, 500 feet thick of ice. And those actually come all the way down into central California. So, you know, if you've been to Yosemite, that marks the southern border of the ice age. But hey, what we got here are thousands of feet of ice as opposed to just hundreds of feet of ice. So yeah, the ice actually went considerably further south. That's also true of Europe and Asia. But notice here what happened over the Tibetan Plateau. You've got an enormous ice sheet that covers literally millions of square kilometers of land. And by the way, a number of geophysicists think that it's, you know, an ice age is coming when you see the accumulation of ice over Tibet. Basically what that does, because it reflects four times more efficiently than ice over Antarctica or Greenland, that once that ice begins to build, you quickly have an ice age. So that's your signal. An ice age is coming when you see ice starting to accumulate in a significant way over the Tibetan Plateau. It just seems to bring about cooling everywhere else. So, but, you know, the point is that if we get another ice age, it's not going to cover the whole planet. It's going to be kind of like this. So it means all the Canadians are going to have to move south as a result of moving into the next ice age. Yes?
When God creates the new heavens and earth, do you think there's going to be an ice age and a new earth?
Okay, this is actually a debate I'm having on my Facebook page right now. I couldn't finish it this morning because I had to get ready for class here. But a number of people are actually thinking the new creation is going to be right here on Earth. It can't be. The physics of the universe, the dimensions of our universe, make it impossible for our universe to sustain life literally for much longer. I mean, we're coming to the end when the entire universe must become sterile. And just because of the fact that, you know, the sun is getting brighter, it will soon be so bright you can't have life anywhere here on planet Earth. And if you want to wait long enough, all the stars burn out, then it gets really cold. So how cold is it going to get when all the stars burn out? It'll be about 3 degrees above absolute zero everywhere in the universe. So it's inevitable that our universe will no longer be able to sustain life.
That's 3 degrees Kelvin.
3 degrees Kelvin, pardon me.
Which is equivalent to, about 450 minus?
It's about minus 454 degrees Fahrenheit. So yeah, you're going to need a jacket. Yes.
So Noah, where was he since he was around 30,000 years ago?
Well, okay, if you read the book over there, Navigating Genesis, it's making the point that the Noahic flood had to be in the last ice age. Why did it have to be in the last ice age? Because the text tells us it took 7.5 months for the waters of the flood to recede. And for it to take that long, you have to have a lot of ice melting. I mean, for example, the mountains surrounding the Persian Gulf and Arabia today are ice-free. But during the last ice age, they were packed with ice. And so, in order to explain how water remained in the Persian Gulf and in the Mesopotamian plain for as long as the text tells us, the water that's flowing out of that region into the Indian Ocean would have to be replaced by snow and ice melt. And hey, some of you can remember 20 years ago when the Mississippi Valley was flooded 50 feet deep, and that flood lasted 4 months. The reason why it lasted so long is because all the water flowing into the Gulf of Mexico was being replaced by a record snowfall that took place that year. And the melting of that snow kept replacing the water that left. So you got the same principle going on with the Noahic flood. And also you've got Genesis 2, which tells us that the Garden of Eden event had to be during the last ice age. Because you got four rivers coming together, all four rivers are flowing. We know the locations of those rivers. Notice in Genesis 2, it tells you where all four rivers flow from. Now, for those four rivers to be flowing, they need to have snow and ice melt. Two of those rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates, are still being fed by snow and ice melt because they're being fed by mountains that are 17,000 feet high. Whereas the Gihon and the Pishon, they were being fed by snow and ice melt from mountains that were 5,000 to 7,000 feet high, which today are bone dry. So those rivers are now dry. And they've been dry for 15,000 years. So that means that you'd have to have the Garden of Eden story during the last ice age, which is why we're on record as reason to believe is saying Adam and Eve lived somewhere between 20 and 120,000 years ago. Because that would be the time where you'd have enough ice to have all four of those rivers flowing.
And that strait where the American Indians, when were they supposed to be over here? Like what year is it here? And when was that together? So
okay, good point. The one thing that's wrong with this diagram you see here, it shows you where the ice was, but it doesn't show you where the land masses were. So during the last ice age, you had a 500-mile wide bridge joining Alaska and Siberia. You also had a bridge joining France and England. You had a bridge joining Korea to Japan. If you have all that ice in the continental land masses, you have the sea levels dropping about 300 feet. And the dropping the sea levels by that 300 feet has all these land bridges, which actually explains Genesis 10. You know, where God scatters humanity out of the Persian Gulf and Mesopotamian region into all the lands of the world. That's possible because there's land bridges that they can walk across. Now today, the land bridges don't no longer exist. And actually, I described in Navigating Genesis, that was one tool God did to ensure that humanity would not repeat the mistake of the pre-flood peoples. In other words, they could have gotten settled over here. Oh, we don't like it. We're going to go back. Well, they couldn't go back. Because of the Bering Strait being so treacherous, they were literally stuck in North and South America. Likewise, the Japanese were stuck on their islands. I mean, you can go on. Yes?
So
to, would the entire planet have been cooler at this time, or would it still been fairly warm in the tropics?
It would have been, okay, the whole globe got cooled by these five tectonic events, so the tropics were not as warm as they were 3 million years ago. So literally everywhere things got cooler. But the tropics never got cold enough to, you know, disturb, quote, the tropical climate or to bring ice down there. Although it's interesting, when you look at, let me see if I can pull this back up again. Okay, something else was going on as this isthmus was forming. You also have tectonic events that are pushing up the mountains, especially the mountains in the Kerguelen Range. The Kerguelen Range, by the way, starts up in Alaska and goes all the way down to the tip of South America. So you've got this mountain range that literally goes all north and south through the Americas. But it is such that you get the greatest uplift near the tropics, which basically forms during the Ice Age. You've got a store of ice that runs the whole length of North and South America. And the melting of that ice waters the Great Plains of North and South America, and to this day we're the beneficiaries of that melting water. For example, we would not be able to grow the food we do in North America if it wasn't for the fact that we're taking advantage of meltwater from the last Ice Age. You say, where's that coming from? Well, the mountains of the Kerguelen Range, and particularly the ice pack that exists in British Columbia. That's feeding the great rivers that water the prairies of North America that allows us to grow food to literally feed billions of people. Yes?
During the time of Noah's flood, were there people in North and South America?
No. I mean, at least that's my interpretation. What you see in Genesis is that God was rebuking humanity for their failure to multiply and fill the earth. He commanded Adam and Eve to do it. We can infer from the text that didn't happen. Notice that God, when he spoke to Noah after the flood, repeated the command, multiply and fill the earth. But if you actually look at it, it's rather strongly toned, the command to multiply and fill the earth. In other words, I told your ancestors to do it. They didn't do it. You must do it. And also made the point, you must stop this at practice of murder. Whatever it takes to restrain murder, you must bring it under check, because God's plan was, I want people living in all the continental land masses, and I want a large population. So he basically said, stop living in one place. And you see that in Genesis 11. Here we are after the flood, and what do the post-flood people say? Let's build a city and a tower so we'll remain in one place and be one people and not be scattered over the face of the earth. God saw that as a prescription for return of the evil that existed in the days before the flood, and basically stepped in and gave them languages, multiple languages, and what you see in the text in Genesis 10 and 11 is he gave these people with different languages different territories with natural boundaries that allowed the small nations to survive next to large nations. And so it's not an accident, I would argue. And when you look at these continental land masses, excuse me, you've got mountains, you've got rivers, you've got lakes, you've got deserts, you've got seashores that provide nations with defensible boundaries. And the whole point here is that God is injecting antitrust legislation. He knows if you've got one powerful nation that rules over all the peoples of the world, you get the same effect as a corporation having exclusive control over a product. And typically what happens is that corporation raises the price of the product and lowers the quality of the product. Likewise, if you go one nation that has exclusive control over its citizens, it tends to abuse its citizens. I mean, a good example of that is what happened in Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia. Where they prevented the free exchange of citizens from one country to another, and they were able to make a great oppression. Or, for example, how the United States flourish. We flourish at the hands of other nations oppressing its citizens. And so many of the oppressed came here and were able to be successful. Yes?
A couple of things I'm having trouble with your numbers of dating here. One, you're saying that the Garden of Eden events between 20 and 120,000 years. I think you said that that was what you were on record for. But there are other research that said humanity's been around for over 200,000 years, I think. And I think I once talked about, you said that was not inconsistent with your ideas, but that would have clearly put it before the last ice age. The other thing is the flood being during the last ice age in order to supply all that snow melt. What during the ice age would have caused an increase in snow melt to keep that whole Mesopotamian region flooded for those months? Did you think there was nothing to cause it to melt during that time, was there?
Well, I mean, you got 40 days of nights of torrential rain, and a high altitude that's going to be snow, and the snow is falling on top of black ice, then you get a more efficient melt. And so all that melting will take place, and that could actually initiate some of the melt of the ice underneath. And so that would explain how it would take longer periods of time.
In an ice age, you have that rapid of melting?
Well, again, we're left to speculate here what exactly was happening during the flood. Was there a warming event that took place? Because we have the text saying that God sent a strong wind to try to get the water out of the area faster. There may have been, we don't know exactly what brought all that rain into the area. The aquifers came up, there were tectonic events. Maybe there were volcanic events taking place. So there's a number of scenarios you could develop to explain why you would get so much snow and ice melt. But my point is this, you've got to have the snow and ice there in the first place in order to get it to melt. If there is no snow and ice there, you don't have a scenario to explain how that water remains for 7.5 months. Now, in terms of the dates, I'm saying just based on the ice age, if that's the only data you got, then Adam and Eve is somewhere between 20 and 120,000 years ago, because that's the extent of the last ice age. But we got other methods to date when Adam and Eve showed up, namely what we call the cultural big bangs. And those cultural big bang signals are coming in at anywhere from 50 to 80,000 years ago. You got the DNA dates, mitochondrial DNA dates, and the Y chromosome dates. And yes, those dates that are being bandied around are placed in the origin of humanity at 200,000 years ago. But there's been a paper, and this is actually in our latest book on human origins, where we actually look at the error bars on that 200,000 years. The error bars are almost 400,000 years. So, yeah, the date is 200,000 years, but it's plus or minus about 350,000 years. So basically our position at Reasons to Believe is the mitochondrial DNA really is not helpful for establishing the date of the origin of humanity. But we do argue that the cultural big bangs are more useful, but even there, the error bars are really big. So, and this is a problem when you read the anthropological literature. Often the error bars aren't stated, and people, especially lay people reading the articles, think, hey, these dates are accurate. They're nowhere near accurate. And by the way, when we're talking about the last ice age, we don't have any accurate dates for this whole period. The dates at best are plus or minus about 10,000 years all the way through, in some cases much worse. So, now, say, where did you get this data? This is ice core data. Here the dates are reliable. So the temperature dates we have here are very reliable because it's all based on annual layers. And so there we have very good precision on the dates, but trying to correlate these temperature changes with other events, that's where you run into difficulties. Yes?
Also, the definition of humanity often differs in the scientific literature from how we use it. We only use it for Homo sapiens, but they don't limit themselves to define humanity. It goes Homo adult to even maybe Homo.
Well, keep in mind that also happens within the Christian community. Younger creationists claim that Adam and Eve gave rise to Neanderthals and Homo sapiens adult, as well as what we would consider to be modern humanity. So yeah, it's a debate that extends considerably.
So when they use humanity in the scientific literature, how far they go before Homo sapiens sapiens when they talk about often humanity? How far back do they? What species?
Okay, in the secular anthropological literature, there too is a debate on what we define to be human beings. Mm-hmm. One definition is that we're only going to count them to be human if they're obligatory bipedal. In other words, what that means is there are species that must walk on two legs. They can't, you know, run around on all fours.
Homo erectus would fit that.
Homo erectus fits that bill. Oh, yeah. Yeah, so a lot of homos would fit that description of being obligatory bipedal. Oh, sorry, I shouldn't have used that term. I apologize.
Correct way to say it.
It is the correct way to say it, but it can be interpreted in other ways. So I got to watch it. This is all being recorded, so I got to be careful here. But there are other anthropologists that would say anything that's capable of bipedal motion would be human. So I would push the date back to 6.5 million years, because that's when you first see, you know, hominid species that are actually able, you know, they don't prefer to walk on two legs, but they can walk on two legs. And by the way, you might say that might even be true of certain species that share the planet with us today. So, for example, if a chimpanzee has a broken arm, it becomes bipedal. So, not, by the way, it's a clumsy bipedal.
Yeah.
And so, there's a range of definitions. But yeah, typically, secular anthropologists, they're talking about humans being around for about 1.8 million years plus. So, okay. What you'll notice about this ice age cycle is, number one, as you move forward, the temperature starts to vary more dramatically. So here the temperature variations are more dramatic. What you notice here too is that you get significant temperature variations even when you're in a warm interglacial. So it's going up and down through here. So for example, you couldn't really have a large human population in this warm interglacial because either side or on, the temperature is simply varying too radically. When you come up to the final, the one we're in right now, you notice that here the temperature is going up and down, but not as dramatically as it did here. Then it hits this peak and it levels off. This is the only, and by the way, let me take you to a more detailed one. This is the only warm interglacial where we've actually had a steady temperature. In fact, this is the only time in the past 2.59 million years where we've had a steady temperature. It's never happened before, the only time. And so, and also notice, we're 4 degrees centigrade below the maximum. What we see in the last ice age is every time the temperature globally goes 4 degrees centigrade above where it is now, it rapidly drops into an ice age. So this is the only one where it went up, it stopped, and has been stable for the past 9,000 years, which is exactly what you need to have a large human population. It's exactly what you need to have global civilization. If you don't have that long period of temperature stability, you can't launch large-scale agriculture, and you can't have a large human population, and you can't have technology. And by the way, we're at the optimal temperature. There is no better temperature for sustaining global high technology civilization. Yes.
What's the actual technique they use for determining this from an ice core? Is it the thickness of the one layer? They just assume that the warmer it was, the less ice was laid down, or is there something more?
Well, in terms of getting the temperature, that's all done through looking at certain isotopes. Notice here what they're measuring is oxygen 18. Oxygen 18, normal oxygen is 16, but there's an isotope of oxygen that's got two extra neutrons in it, and that isotope is very sensitive to temperature. So they're using oxygen 18 in the different layers as a proxy for the temperature. And what you see here is two different ice cores. There's actually four cores here, two in Greenland and two in Antarctica. And that gives you a northern hemisphere and a southern hemisphere measure of the temperature. But what you see there, it's rapidly varying, except for here. You get a steady temperature in all the ice cores over the past 9,000 years. And that's what makes possible launching large-scale agriculture, which makes possible having a large human population. Okay, how much more time do I got? 10 minutes? I'll take these two questions quickly, but I want to get into a text here. Go ahead.
Really quick, have they found an scientific explanation for why there's that long warm period we're in now?
A few speculations, no decent explanation. Most of the speculations for why we have this incredible stability is human activity. The way we've domesticated chickens and cows, for example, are considered to have had an effect on bringing about this stable situation. But there's also been a number of research papers making the point that you have to watch the numbers. In other words, to keep it this stable, you're going to want to have different numbers of domesticated animals at different times. And there's even people being concerned that if we've got too many or too few chickens or too many or too few cows, or if we breed our cows to produce too much or too little milk, we're going to disturb this balance. So, but the bottom line is nobody really knows for sure what explains that. All we got are speculations, but most of the speculations are in the context of human activity. Yes?
The post-interglacial temperature drops seem to be more gradual with each successive event. Is that accurate, or is that an artifact of the measurement?
No, that's accurate. Let me see if I can pull this back for you. Is that, we do see that there's a gradual temperature drop, which is simply in line with the idea that as the Tibetan Plateau goes up, you expect each successive ice age to be more severe. Now, what's not being shown here is the ice coverage. So as we move forward in time, the ice coverage at maximum is getting greater and greater, and the thickness of the ice is getting greater and greater. But yeah, that's reflected in the fact that the bottom temperature is getting lower and lower. Yeah, okay. Now, is this really God's plan? Let me take you to the book of Revelation, chapter 7, verse 6. And here's, you know, John on the island of Patmos, and he's get to see a vision. And his vision is what the new creation is going to look like. And he says, after this I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one can count, from every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and in front of the Lamb. They were wearing white robes and were holding palm branches in their hands, and they cried out in a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne." Excuse me, my pages are sticking together. "And to the Lamb. And all the angels are standing around the throne and around the elders, the four living creatures. They fell down on their faces before the throne and worshiped God." And then they come up with a worship psalm there. What I want you to notice is it's making the point that the redeemed of humanity is not going to be a small number. Every tribe, language, people. You know, when Jesus left the planet, he told his disciples, Matthew 28, "I want you to take the good news to all the people groups of the world, beginning in Jerusalem, then Judea, Samaria, and to the uttermost parts of the earth." And it was a command to reach every people group, every ethnic group. And here we see in Revelation 7 that there will be a time in the kingdom of heaven when there will be a huge multitude literally representing every nation, every tribe, every language, every people group. And by the way, there have been missiologists here at Fuller Seminary and at the U.S. Center for World Mission who have done an extensive study on what this word ethnos means that we see here in the Greek, and actually have made the point it means more than just every language that's ever spoken. It literally means every ethnic group. And not only in terms of genetic ethnicity, but also in terms of employment ethnicity. So making the point that wherever you've got a group of people that are kind of a population unto themselves, which could be a group of, say, of software engineers. I've worked with software engineers. They're kind of an isolated people group. and they like being an isolated people group. But the whole point is there will be large numbers of software engineers. They'll be part of this crowd here in heaven. But and incidentally, when it makes the point, a great multitude, it defines what that great multitude is. So there's a great multitude that no one could count for every nation, tribe, language, people. Now, this was written in Greek, first century Greek. And we know from first century Greek, they had a counting system. And they had various numbers, and they were able to count up to large numbers. How large would they go? their counting system stopped at myriads of myriads. Say, great, what's a myriad? A myriad equals 10,000. So myriads of myriads are 10,000 times 10,000. So it was no problem for first century Greeks to handle a billion. A billion was simply 10 myriads of myriads. And when you talk about something being countless, it means it's greater than a few billion. So it's literally saying that this multitude in heaven is going to be numbering into the multiple billions at least. And to number into the multiple billions at least, we need a planet that can sustain billions of people at one time. And that's only possible if you have these five tectonic events happening at the same time, roughly 3 million years ago, and having a 100,000-year ice age cycle where we follow the most severe of those last eight ice ages that took place, which is what enables our planet today to sustain 7 billion people. And, you know, there will be many of those 7 billion that will be part of this prophesied host here in Revelation chapter 7. Now, I'm running out of time. I may have to leave this to next week. But where I want to go next is what this text, what I want to do is kind of take you through all 66 books of the Bible quickly and show you quickly, because we're only going to look at one theme. The theme we're going to look at, okay, God made it possible for us to live on this planet with 7 billion people. He also made it possible for us to have the kind of civilization and technology where we could communicate with one another. What exactly was the strategy and what was the means that God has given us to actually accomplish this task of bringing billions of people from every tribe, nation, language, people group, ethnicity, employment ethnicity, into a relationship with Jesus Christ in a sufficient time? Because if I go back to this, this isn't going to last much longer. Now, you've heard the global warming people saying, we're going to warm the planet and this is going to be catastrophic. Well, in one sense, they're right. If we warm the planet by 4 degrees centigrade, we're probably going to rapidly drop into an ice age. And so, but no matter what we do, we can't sustain this much longer. We've had it for 9,000 years. I think one thing that concerns me about this political debate over global warming is like we human beings think we have a right to a stable, optimal temperature for the planet. Hey, we've only had it for 9,000 years in the past 4.6 billion year history of the Earth. Why do we think we've got a right for a permanent, optimal, stable temperature? This is a narrow time window in which God has blessed us with this, but it's also making a point. We who are followers of Jesus Christ need to hurry up because the Lord is not giving us much more time to fulfill the Great Commission. But what I want to share with you next week is what this text says about how we're supposed to go about fulfilling this Great Commission so we get it done before what they call this long, cool summer comes to an end. Yes?
Would you say that the editors of your next book are moving at a glacial pace or a tectonic?
Well, I'm trying to move the editors at a less than glacial pace so that the book will get out in time, that maybe it can have an impact on making people realize now is the time to fulfill this command that God has given us. In fact, what I'm going to be sharing with you next week, we literally have the tools within our hands. I say we who are serious followers of Jesus Christ, we got everything we need to take this good news of salvation through Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world, whether they be ethnic groups or employment affinities. We can do that in 10 years. It can be done that fast. We have all the resources. The one resource we're lacking is motivation. And maybe if we kind of spread the good news, hey, you know, this remarkable temperature stability we've had isn't going to last a whole lot longer. Maybe we need to get a little more serious about fulfilling the command of Matthew 20. By the way, when I say much longer, I could conceive where this could be sustained for another 1,000 years. I also can conceive where it would end in 100 years. So, or even 50. So somewhere between 50 and 1,000 years, this remarkable climate stability we've been enjoying will come to an end. but it could be 1,000 years off. But, you know, when I was speaking at Reformed Theological Seminary in Orlando, a number of the theology professors there were saying, you know, we think the fulfillment of the Great Commission is going to happen within the next 3 million years. And I said, well, if you're going to push it out 3 million years, we got a problem here. This can't be sustained for 3 million years.
And why?
Pardon me?
Why
were they saying it was going to take 3 million
why
years?
Why can't that be sustained?
Well, you got the... Tibet is still going up. So that's happening. And also, we still have the change in the eccentricity of Earth's orbit. So that eventually is going to bring about a cooling effect. And then there are climatologists who are saying, you know, maybe the trigger is us pushing the temperature up another 3 or 4 degrees centigrade. Because did you notice with these ice ages? The ice age does not get ignited until the temperature reaches about 4 degrees centigrade above where it is now. And every time it has hit that, notice how rapidly you get a drop-off into an ice age. So, and then they've been talking about, well, what is it that a higher temperature does? Well, one thing we know a higher temperature would do is melt the polar ice cap. In fact, in my lifetime, half of the polar ice cap has melted away. So just in one generation, we've seen half of the ice cap melt away. And there are people thinking, you know, in another 60 years, there'll be no polar ice cap. Now, if you got no polar ice cap, what does that mean? Well, let me go back to here we go. Okay. If you've got no polar ice cap, you still got this warm Gulf Stream coming in here. And what that does is it starts evaporating that water. And so if you got open Arctic ice or open Arctic Ocean and you got warm water coming in here, that's going to cause that to evaporate. And what happens when that water evaporates? It falls as snow over Canada and Siberia. And so that's one model for what ignites an ice age. It's simply the melting of the polar ice cap. Now, as long as it's frozen over, you're not going to get much evaporation. But if it's open water, you will get evaporation. And with that evaporation, you can start piling up snow over Canada and Siberia. You know, as warm as our planet is right now, Canada and Siberia would be packed with ice if it wasn't a desert. Northern Canada and Siberia, they get 10 inches of precipitation or less per year. Anywhere else in the world, it would be a desert. But because it's so cold there, 10 inches is enough to sustain forests. So you've got gigantic forests that cover northern Canada and Siberia. They only need a little bit of precipitation, given that there's going to be hardly any evaporation because of how cold it is. But if you push it up to 20 inches precipitation equivalent, now you've got thousands of feet of ice pouring up over. And by the way, if you go back to Antarctica, that 2 million cubic miles of ice, that was all generated by just a few inches of precipitation per year. It adds up over time. Okay.
No more questions. I'm sorry.
We got out of time.
And I also have a shameless plug here.
Okay. Shameless plug.
We were out of these, but we have them in stock again here. So see Colleen. Colleen, wait. As we have, Hugh took these pictures, and there's Bible verses and some saying all by Hugh. So we have a pocket picture book. It makes a wonderful stocking stuffer, you know, so if you're looking for stocking stuffers, Colleen has got a stock of these in over there now, and so you got pictures, and also a cover's got a picture of Kathy on it. And is this a Jeep you rented, I take it?
It's a Jeep we rented, and I had to spend hours getting it out of a gigantic mud hole. So she looks a lot cleaner than I did when we took that photo.
That was in Hawaii, obviously. It's like Hawaiian license plate, right?
Yeah, we were trying to get to what's called the blue hole in Hawaii, and we did not make it.
Too much mud. Anyway, so we do have these in stock. As we pray, speaking of snow and ice, we're not out of the drought in California, but this last storm, I'm happy to report, did put a lot of snow on the Sierras, and so the drought's going to be a little less severe than it was here in California, but that means don't start watering your lawns and take a whole bunch of water. We're not out of the drought, but at least we're breathing a little bit easier here.
We're
so
going to get some more rain.
We hope we'll get some more rain. This last storm was called the Pineapple Express, because it was a storm that came directly from Hawaii to California. It was not a northern storm. which is why we had 3 mini tornadoes along the coast here in California. We get those occasionally, 3 little tornadoes, and most severe along the coast here. So let's thank the Lord for our ice cap that we have here in our Sierras, yeah. And close in prayer.
Okay, we'll do that. And by the way, you can save your question for next week. You want the whole class to hear it, or you can talk to me afterwards. So, but yeah, people have been asking me, how much more rain do we need to be out of this drought? We need 150 days more rain. So probably not going to happen. But Father in heaven, we do thank you for the rain we received. Thank you for the beauty of the snow that now sits on our mountains. It's been a long time since we've seen snow like that, and we're grateful for the slow melt that will take place that will continue to feed our reservoirs. And we look forward to more rain that you'll bless us with. But Father, we also look forward to this Christmas season, a time when it's just so easy to talk to people about your Son that you sent here. So Father, I pray you would give each of us here many opportunities to take advantage of what this season is all about, to be able to share our belief in you and, Lord, our desire to see our friends and relatives and associates also join us in becoming those who will be part of this great multitude that's mentioned in Revelation chapter 7. So give us grace, give us humility, give us wisdom as we share the reasons we have for the hope within us. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.